Michael Crummy, who is most recently the author of Galore. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks.
I wanted to first of all start with a rather intriguing aspect of this book. Among some of the poorer families, there's a common theme of childbearing, sharing some common affliction. I'm thinking of Druce hiding her miscarriages in the graveyard.
Right.
There's, of course, the family in which all the kids seem to suffer from Prejoria.
Right.
There are also a number of, like, grisly deaths that seem to kind of emerge more out of irresponsible life decisions rather than the actual act of living in this really hard town. I'm curious about death in this book. It's extremely bizarre and very, very grisly, but I'm wondering why there's so much of it and why it's also, you have the concatenation of casualties among
right.
these mothers.
Right. Well, in particular, the deaths in early childhood or in birth.
Yeah.
I was just mirroring the facts of the place itself in those times. Even in my father's generation, you know, early years of the last century, the 20s and the 30s, the number of children who died in childbirth or shortly afterwards were astronomical, and every family had one or two or three or four children who didn't make it past the age of one or two.
Yeah.
And infant mortality in those communities was huge. And there were all kinds of factors related to that, mostly that there was just no health care available to these people at all. You know, these
yeah.
communities were incredibly isolated. And there was usually one older person in the community who, just by dint of having been around for a long time, knew something about taking care of that kind of thing, who became the midwife for the community. But really, when things went wrong, there was no recourse, you know? And I think that's one thing we've forgotten about. You know, I've had all kinds of friends who have nearly died in childbirth, but because they have access to 20th century medicine,
or 21st century medicine.
They've yeah. come through it and they're fine. But 50 years earlier,
yeah.
they or their child would have died in those situations. And I think that was a really common thing. And I was just trying to reflect how present that was for these people, how and what a fact of life that was, how it was devastating for them, but it was not a surprise.
Yeah.
You know, that these things.
But by having, for example, all the children suffer strange forms of death, I mean, in terms of, they seem strange only in terms of the facts that they come in series.
Right.
And I'm wondering if your, something like this comes about similar to how Judah emerges from a whale only to become a more, I suppose, cemented figure in the book, that your investigation of historical realities led you, in at least the first case, to go more magical, and in the second case, to go more real.
Right.
What was the driving motivation to go from one, to oscillate from one extreme to the other like that?
Well, part of the whole motivation for the book was, and in terms of how it's set up, because there is clearly this
yeah.
element to it that is magic realist, for lack of a better term. It's a lousy term, and I dislike it intensely, but I can't think of a better one for
yeah.
it. And on the other hand, I want it to give a real sense of how relentlessly difficult these people's lives were. But what I was trying to get across, I think, in the book was that for those people in Outport, Newfoundland, there was no separation between those two things. When I was doing the research for the book, it became increasingly clear to me that people in those communities lived between two worlds. And one was this incredibly brutal, difficult physical world, the ocean, the stark rock that they lived on. And on the other side of that was this kind of nether world that they had populated with stuff they'd brought from the old countries, with fairy stories and superstitions and folk cures and those sorts of things, ghost stories. And to them, each of those worlds was equally real. They made no distinction between them in terms of how real they were and how much of an effect they had on their daily lives. So particularly at the opening of the book, what I wanted was to create a world where both of those things were equally true for those people. So they accepted them at face value. right? There was no questioning. This guy comes out of the whale, fine, he's still alive, okay. He's living down the road. And or there's a ghost in the house up the road, and here's the story of how the ghost ended up there. But there's no sort of like, oh, come on, you know, it's that netherworld is just as real to them as the fish that they take out of the ocean. So that's how the book, I tried to have the book exist in both of those worlds at the same time.
Well, to touch upon the ghost stories, I should point out that both part one and part two have a dominant specter in each. Part one, of course, has Mr. Gallery, who may actually be a magical specter or may, in fact, be a perceptive specter. And then in part two, I don't want to give it away, but you have one character who becomes something of a ghost going ahead and writing those psalms on the wall and the like. I'm wondering if this concern for dead entities, so to speak, comes more from your historical investigations or more from a need to remind the reader that, hey, there's a whole set of characters who are going to replace these new characters. Be familiar with the stench of death, so to speak.
Right. I guess in some ways, in some ways, I think I was interested in the way that we're haunted by our past. And in Newfoundland, I think this is particularly true because the past is so close still. You know, like the Newfoundland up until 1949 when it joined Canada was, the way people lived in Newfoundland was pretty close to how they'd lived there for a couple of hundred years, you know?
Yeah.
So the world that my father and mother grew up in was almost medieval in some ways, you know? And within the space of their lifetime, we entered the 21st century, and the world that I grew up in was completely different. And so I feel haunted by the ghosts of those people in a particular way. But also, I had written a couple of novels before this that were based on particular historical events.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to write about the history of Newfoundland in this book so much as I wanted to write about the folklore of the place.
Yeah.
Because to me, that's what makes Newfoundland unique and different from anywhere else in Canada and probably in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess what I was playing with, particularly with Judah, who kind of disappears, you know, in the second half of the book, there's a point where people think he's in a particular location for a long time, though nobody has laid eyes on him. And when they finally go to look for him, he's gone. And so at that point, those people don't know, some of those people who weren't around before he sort of disappeared into this room, don't know if he was ever more than just a story. And what I was interested in playing with was how a lot of these stories out of Newfoundland folklore that I was using in this book and playing with, a lot of people have asked me, are those stories true? Did those things really happen? And my answer is always, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
What matters is that those stories have lasted, and those stories are still being told, and they're still shaping who we are. So what's real about Newfoundland and about Newfoundland's past are those stories, to me. Those are the things that are really important and lasting about the place.
Yeah.
So these ghosts are in some ways the same thing. Like, are they real or not? You know, like, at a certain point, it's the story that matters. The story is the important thing about Judah.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not the first half of the book is true, whether or not that's how he arrived or it's just a story that was generated, is irrelevant. The story is what matters. And the whole book, in a way, circles around to that at the end with the character who has been sent overseas to the war, loses his memory in a bombing raid, and becomes kind of a non-person, you know? He's forgotten who he is, he has no idea where he's come from. And what saves him, what gives him back to himself, are these stories that he's been told as he grew up, you know? And to me, that's the story of all places, but in particular Newfoundland, you know, like that. There's this circular thing where Newfoundlanders tell these stories, make up these stories and tell them, and now those stories are telling us who we are as Newfoundlanders.
Yeah.
And so that I was trying to mirror that in the book as well.
Well, speaking of the Great War, I was sort of stunned that the novel actually went beyond the 19th century. It's like, oh, well, he kind of went a little bit beyond his 100 years there, so to speak. I'm wondering why you needed to align this community directly up to the Great War like that, to have this specific pre-modern connotation with the timeline here.
Right. Well, there was a very particular movement that I was wanting the book to follow. And I think the book's closer to probably 200 years, although I was deliberately vague about where it starts. And I wanted the book to start somewhere that just feels like way back there.
Yes.
And in some ways, the world that those people are living in is closer to 300 or 400 years ago than even 100 years before the Great War, you know, or 200 years ago. But I was deliberately vague about not only when that was happening, but where exactly this community is in Newfoundland. Because I wanted to feel like it could be anywhere in Newfoundland at any time in the distant past. And I think it's not until the very near the end of part one that I actually mention a date.
Yeah.
I think 1898 is the first year that's mentioned. But in the process of leading up to that, of course, this world that is kind of self-contained and off on its own, the outside world starts impinging on it in different ways. The priest arrives, and the school arrives, and the doctor arrives. So the modern world begins showing up in this place. And the netherworld that had played such a huge role in that place gets pushed a little further and further into the shadows as the modern world arrives.
And religion before medicine, which is a very interesting decision.
Right. Well, I mean, that was absolutely true of the place.
Yeah.
I mean, and in some ways, they arrived together, you know.
Yeah.
Newfoundland, back in the 1800s, late 1800s, was a place that missionaries were sent to. They would send missionaries to the Third World, to Africa and South America and Newfoundland, because these people had been basically left on their own for a couple of hundred years, and they had no religion. You know, they were just living wild in these places in some ways.
Did that motivate the dissolute initial?
Sure.
Religious figure? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Father Phelan, who's one of my favorite characters in the book, when I was doing the research for the book, I knew that Catholicism was officially outlawed at the time that the Irish were first settling Newfoundland in larger numbers. And I discovered that, you know, they were served by these itinerant priests or friars who sort of roved around and said Mass in secret. And they seemed that these priests seemed to fall into two categories, and one were priests who were completely committed to their vocation and to the church and to the people they were serving. They were looked upon as saints by the people they served. And on the other hand were these complete reprobates who seemed to have been kicked out of everywhere else in Christendom and had ended up here, and they were drunkards and they slept around, and they were a couple of them were excommunicated eventually. And I thought, instead of trying to write one or the other, I would try to write a character who was both of those things at the same time, because that seems to be the nature of the church anyway. It's both of those things at the same time.
Yeah.
And so Father Phelan became what he is, and that was that was a lot of fun to try to get down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's also interesting that, to my mind, you mentioned the netherworld, and I that really reflects, I think, my reading experience too, because I got the sense that both religion and capitalism were these tremendous shrouds to really hide the way that these people live, which is very much hand-to-mouth, very much a matter of, well, how can we survive when there's no fish in the water?
Right.
How can we survive when we're cut off or we're reliant upon one chief source of getting our flour and the like?
Right.
I'm wondering to what degree you intended some of these systematic interventions, religion, exploitation, as ways of hiding the netherworld in the course of designing this book.
I mean, again, I think I was just trying to describe the society as it existed.
Sure.
And as it developed as well. I mean, the system that the fishermen lived under was something called the truck system.
Yeah.
And that continued in Newfoundland right up to the 1940s, 1950s, I think, until fishermen's unions finally were able to break some of that hold that these merchants had. And the truck system, what it did was it allowed merchants would fit out the fishermen for the season. They would give them everything they needed on credit, on condition that the fishermen then sold all their fish to them at the end of the season. But the merchant set the prices both for the stuff given on credit and for the fish that came in. So what that meant was that most fishermen never saw a cent of cash money in their lives.
Yeah.
And in seasons when the fishing went badly, they ended up badly in debt. And I think, to be fair, a lot of those merchants in these isolated areas, they were not getting rich either.
Yeah. But
it was definitely a system that was designed to keep the fishermen from ever making a go of it.
Yeah.
And I was amazed when I was doing the research for this book to see how cyclical the fish were in terms of there were a number of boom years where the fish seemed to be jumping into the boats, and then there would be years where they just didn't show up.
Yeah.
And in those years, I mean, people suffered. Like, up until probably the late 1800s, there was no government assistance whatsoever.
Yeah.
And even after that, it was absolute minimal. So I was just trying to, I think I wanted all of Newfoundland to happen in this one tiny community. I wanted everything that that place is and was to happen in this one little tiny imaginary place that I created. So I was trying to stuff it all in there.
Well, we haven't even gotten into the notion of how you organized all this. Did you have a sort of Faulkner Yokunapatafa map on the wall with diagrams? I mean, to some degree, if you are so concerned with world building and so concerned with history, it's going to be a very delicate balance for you to organize this. And also, when we know that there's a new set of characters coming, well, you have to make sure that not only are the characters all distinct, but, for example, the Sellers family line, we see evolution among generations in terms of how they deal with the fishermen.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering about how this organizational process was for you, and whether there is an inherent risk when it comes to a massive world that you're creating, that you have to make certain trade-offs that a character who may haunt you, as you indicated earlier, may not necessarily haunt the text nearly as much as you had hoped, or you have to sort of, you know, cut them off, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, the organizationally, I just sort of jumped into this book. I mean, I did research for about a year, and this book would never have happened if not for reading 100 Years of Solitude by Marquez. And it was a book that I had avoided for years because I was pretty sure I would dislike it because I didn't really like the notion of magic realism.
Yeah.
But when I read it, I was shocked. I mean, there was tons in there that was completely foreign to me, but I kept thinking, this is just like home. This is just like Newfoundland, particularly in the way that the otherworldly was accepted as an everyday part of people's lives. And the multi-generational way that that story was told, I kept thinking, there's a story about Newfoundland to be written in much the same way. So I stole the whole notion of a community that like his Macondo is in Colombia, but it's nowhere on the map, you know. I had this notion of creating a community that was in Newfoundland but somehow separate from it. And I decided I would have two families that I would follow, one English and one Irish. Because Newfoundland, I think about 95% of people living in Newfoundland today are direct descendants of the English and Irish settlers, about 18,000 original settlers, 50% English, 50% Irish. So I had that setup of the two families, and of course the English and the Irish didn't get along very well. So I had this idea of enmity between the two families to start. But I also wanted to, I mean, there was a point where people in Newfoundland stopped being English or Irish and became Newfoundlanders, which was some kind of weird mix of the two.
Yeah.
So that was how those storylines would play out with the back and forth between the families. But outside of that, I didn't have much of a plan. I had different characters that I knew I wanted in the book. I knew I wanted this alcoholic opera singer who's based on a real person. I knew I wanted this priest figure, the Father Phelan figure. I had ideas like that. But basically, I started writing on page one of the book, and I just wrote my way through it. And so I didn't do any of this mapping out. I just sort of tried to follow my nose. And my only question when I was deciding what comes next was, Am I entertained by this?
Yeah.
Is this an interesting turn? And and it was a real challenge because each generation of these families has to have elements of the previous generation, but has to be somehow unique as well to hold the reader's interest.
Yeah.
So, but it was really just basically every day saying, okay, what happens now? Where can I take these folks?
Yeah. But in terms of character balancing, if you're running into the jungle and wildly whacking around with a machete, I mean, there needs to be something systematic, particularly if you hope to arrange it in any sort of coherence.
Right.
So,
yeah,
I mean,
well, yeah. I definitely had particular themes that the book was following that, in a way, map the trajectories for each of these characters and for each of the generations.
Yeah.
I mean, I was playing with the whole notion. Newfoundland's a tiny place. It's about 500,000 people. I mean, it's a big geographically, but it's a tiny community. It's 500,000 people today. And, you know, 100 years ago, I think it was less than half of that. And 100 years before that, it was minuscule, maybe 20, 30,000 people. So everybody's related.
Yeah.
And the gene lines between those generations, I mean, there are researchers from all over the world in Newfoundland studying because they can map how these genes cross generations because there's been so little contamination, for lack of a better word. So I wanted to play with that in the book. So when I started out with Judah, for example, I knew that the book was going to end with a direct descendant of Judah, who, and of course some of Judah's characteristics, the smell, the white skin, and all that was passed on.
Yeah.
And I knew that I wanted the book to end with someone who was in some way saved by being the direct descendant and having those characteristics. So all the way along, of course, I had this map to follow where these particular characteristics had to be passed down, and then to do something interesting with those characteristics all the way along before I got to this end point.
Does this explain in part some of the copious cock imagery throughout the book? I mean, lots of blades and penises.
Right.
I mean, lots of propagation, I found. Yeah.
Yes, well, I mean, partly that was homage to Marquez as well.
Yes.
Because every penis in Marquez is monstrous.
Yes,
it's huge.
No pun intended.
And that was just, again, something else I stole from Marquez.
Yeah.
But the whole sense of propagation, I mean, this was a place that was incredibly difficult to survive in. And my sense of it is that only people with an incredible life force in them would have made it.
Yeah.
You know? So
this explains in part the considerable virility of many of these characters.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, and it is pretty astonishing. When you go to the old graveyards in Newfoundland, the graves seem primarily to be divided into two categories, and there are people who died before they were 15, often of some disease or drowning or whatever, and then there are people who died when they were 98, you know, so the people who were strong enough to survive past the 15th year seem to go on forever.
Yeah.
So there is a sense of unbelievable stubborn virility in these communities, and often sometimes there's not much life-affirming about it, even. You know, I wanted to get that sense across, that in some sense it just seems like a stupid animal stubbornness that keeps these people going.
Well, based off of your research, what's the dip like in terms of the middle age, in terms of death?
Well, I mean, to be fair, I would say that most people didn't live much past 55.
Yeah.
Right? And that 50 was considered old.
Yeah.
And there were, in every community, there's this group of people who lived to ancient years. But for most people, I think they were broken by the life they were forced to live. By the time they were 50, they were probably crippled, you know, by the work that they were forced to do, and by the fact that the women in particular probably started having children in their teens and would continue to have them until it killed them,
yeah,
almost, you know.
I'm curious, we've brought up Marquez a couple of times, and I'm wondering at what point during the writing did you shake off the inevitable yoke of influence?
Right. Well, I mean, I was a little concerned when I first started talking about this book with people about even bringing Marquez up, because there's something
you brought it up here just for the record.
Oh yeah, you know, I'm much more comfortable with it now over time, because it's ridiculous to there's Marquez and then there's me.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that gave me the courage to try the book was the fact that I felt like Newfoundland and Newfoundland culture was every bit as rich and bizarre and otherworldly and maddening as the world that Marquez was writing about. And I kind of trusted that to create its own uniqueness as I wrote the book. So it made me feel unafraid to steal what I needed from Marquez and to see that almost as a roadmap for a way to tell the story. Because I knew that the stories and the place I was writing about were so unique unto themselves that they could create their own, if I let them be, they would create their own world. And I feel like I did that. I feel like a lot of people, when they read this book, I think of Marquez. But I haven't, at least I haven't heard anyone yet say it's just a Marquez knockoff.
Yeah.
Because the place itself is so completely different.
Yeah.
That it it stands on its own feet, I think, as a culture.
Yeah. It was more of a narrative canvas,
a map
on the wall with which to go ahead and put your push pins in. From your research.
Right.
Why Marquez more than, say, Moby Dick or some other tremendous book? I mean, why did it have to be Marquez? It was just a serendipitous reading choice that you kind of found, oh, well, I see how he's arranging all this wild, all these wild stories.
Well, it's partly serendipity. Yeah. You know, like I was on a reading tour, a promotional tour for the novel previous to this one. I was being interviewed by a guy who worked at a bookstore. I was waiting outside for him. There was a tray of books, Hurt Penguins, I think they were, or something like books that were half price because they were damaged.
Yes.
There was Marquez. I needed a book for the plane. I'd been avoiding him for decades. I thought, oh, well, to hell with it. I'll just try it and see. And as I said earlier, as I was reading it, I was just struck by how familiar so much of that book was and how much it felt like the world that I had come from. And I have, in everything I've written, there have been elements of this netherworld. But it just sort of had shown up as kind of a side piece or like just almost a footnote to the story that I was writing. And I realized as I was reading Marquez that there was a book, there was a novel to be written that dealt specifically with that netherworld, that was in which that netherworld was the engine of the entire novel.
Yeah.
So it was probably just that I was in the right place at the right time. I found with each of my books, there's been one or two books that I've happened on that have kind of sparked me to think about a particular story in a way I'd never thought about it before or had shown me directions that I hadn't considered. In this case, it was way more direct. That sort of, the map was way more obvious to me, and my use of the techniques that I was taking was more direct as well.
Yeah.
But it's always been something that I've looked at. And I mean, Moby Dick is interesting because I'm just reading it for the first time, and I'm noticing in the footnotes how much he did the same with that book in terms of there are sources where he just stole wholeheartedly from, you know, in terms of creating this world in Moby Dick. And it feels very familiar to me, that process of finding work that other people have done and seeing in it something that I can rip off, basically, to create a world of my own.
Sure. Well, this also leads me to ask why you were so resistant to Marquez and magical realism for so long. Were you suspicious of the idea of just, did it seem just too much like bullshit or what?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think my problem was I probably had read a couple of bad books that included magic realism.
Yeah.
And it seemed like a cheat. It seemed like it allowed the writer to be lazy.
Yeah.
You know, because if anything can happen, then the writer can do whatever the hell they want.
Yeah.
And if they ever get stuck, well, it's sort of this deus ex machina thing where they can just I don't know, throw in a ghost or throw in a lightning bolt or whatever.
You need order.
Well, it just felt to me like that it was untrue to the world in a way that pissed me off.
Yeah.
But when I was reading Marquez, the thing that struck me and that reminded me of the place I came from, and there was an afterword in the edition I had in which Marquez talked about trying to write 100 Years of Solitude 4 or 5 or 6 times and failing miserably until he decided he had to write those stories in the way his grandparents told them, which was as if they were absolutely true.
Yeah.
As if they were like, as if he was just describing the weather.
Yes.
And it really, really struck me that that's exactly how my memory of how the older people I grew up around, how they related to that world, you know? Even when I was working on this book, I remember talking to friends of my parents, John and Mary Fitzgerald, who, they're old-time Newfoundlanders, you know? They grew up in a world, as I said, completely different from the one I did. And I was asking them about witches. And I said, you know, was there any talk about that sort of stuff when you were growing up? And Mary started to answer me, and John got up and left the room.
Yes.
And didn't come back. And after a few minutes, I said, John, is he all right? And she said, oh, he won't talk about this stuff. Because even talking about it is a way of inviting it into your life. And so there was no sense that there's, it was just that those, that kind of thing is just as real as the ground you're walking on.
Yeah.
You know, or the rain that's falling. And so that to me is completely different. It's not magic realism, it's real realism.
Yes.
Right? It's writing the world as it is. So there was nothing unnatural about the way those things were put together because it was real to those people. And that's the sense that I was trying to recreate in the book.
You mentioned in your complaints of your early complaints about magical realism, this idea of not being able to believe it. How much does the mechanical laws of a universe, how much do they really matter in the telling of a story? Or was this book almost a way for you to sort of learn not to be so much of a nitpicker when it comes to this kind of thing?
Well, I think it's, like all writing, of course, there are ways to go about it that ring true to a reader, and there are ways to go about it that don't. And every reader draws their line somewhere different in terms of what they're willing to accept, right? And I guess it was just that my line is drawn somewhere different.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I read Marquez that I finally found the place where writing that kind of magic realism felt genuine to me. There was no fakery about it. From what I could tell, it felt completely true to the culture and to the people that he was writing about. And so that was all I was doing in this book. And I think I had done in other books in little bits and pieces. But this is the first time that I decided I was just going to let that be my guide and to not censor myself in any way in terms of... I decided I was never going to worry about whether or not something seemed realistic because that was irrelevant to the culture that I was writing about.
Yeah.
You know, that I was trying to decide, how would you start a book like this? You know, I'd done all this research, I had found amazing stories that I felt like I could create something really interesting out of. But I thought, how in the hell do I start this? Like, where does a book like this begin?
Yeah.
And I was standing in my kitchen, and I this song that I grew up singing in school called Jack Was Every Inch a Sailor came into my head. It's a stupid song. I've since discovered it's actually an English dance hall song. But it's become a part. Every Newfoundlander grows up singing it. And it's about a whaler who gets swept overboard and is swallowed by a whale. And, of course, there's also the story of Jonah. And the Bible was huge in Outport, Newfoundland. It was a huge part of the church, and the scripture was huge in how people saw the world and made sense of the world. And I loved how there was those two things touched, the biblical side of things and the folklore side of things. So I thought, that's it. I'll just start with a guy coming out of the belly of a whale.
Yeah.
And just go from there. I thought, okay, he'll probably stink pretty badly. And he'll probably, what? He'll be bleached white.
Yes.
And then I'll just let these people figure out who he is.
Yeah.
And not worry about, so I didn't, I just thought, if I trust the place, there's a story that'll come out of that that'll carry the book.
Yeah. So the tension is almost this magical realist burst that is meant to be interpreted, much like the Bible, by these very real figures. So that was your way in, almost.
Sure. And I mean, the Bible, when you look at the stories in it, I mean, it's pure magic realism,
sure.
Just in terms of how the otherworldly exists in these people's lives and how bizarre the things are that happen in these stories are. And I think that was part of what shaped these people's response to the world around them as well, and how that netherworld was made to feel real to them. You know, it's a sense that, well, the Word of God, of course, is full of this stuff. So, of course, they would accept that at face value.
Did the faith of your characters help your own faith in believing the universe that you were creating? I mean, on some level, you have to be aware that, well, you're writing a novel. It's essentially a product of fakery.
Yeah.
So I guess your characters, it seems to me, almost served as middlemen for you to believe in this and actually not have this tension of, well, I can't believe it, and so forth.
Right. I'd made the same decision, I think, that Marquez did.
Yeah.
Right? And that I thought, I'm just going to... Because there's no real center to the book in some ways. Like, the place is the center.
Yeah.
And the narrative sort of travels in and out of different characters' lives and stories. And I wanted to write it in a way that whenever I was writing from within a character, the narrative voice believed their world completely. So, I mean, there's the atheist doctor who's married to this born-again woman who acts as his nurse, and I wanted, in both of those cases, for the narrative to believe their worldviews completely.
Yes.
And in a way, I guess, the whole book was my attempt to honor this place I came from and the people who survived it and in some ways flourished there. And so I wanted the narrative to honor each of those characters individually, you know, as they had their moment. So I just decided the book was going to believe everybody.
Yes.
You know, completely and utterly. And there are different levels to that, you know. As the book progresses, a lot of the magic realism from the early parts of the book are kind of doubted by people who come along later, you know,
yeah.
In the same way that folklore is created.
Yeah.
I wanted to mirror that in the book as well.
It's oral belief as opposed to written belief.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, but I wanted to write a book that was completely without cynicism. You know, I wanted the narrative to be... I have a friend who read the book and he said he felt like the place was telling the story. And I loved that, right? That was not what I was thinking at all as I was writing, but it feels completely right for what I was going for.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that seems to be a very good note to close this conversation with Michael. Thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Right, thanks.